nationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author Steve Klein sits down with the most fascinating difference makers in Dallas-Fort Worth. Hear from top CEOs, local entrepreneurs, and key playmakers in business right now with your host, Steve Klein.
An unknown author said, "Great people are ordinary people with extraordinary amounts of determination." Hi, I'm Steve Klein, and welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. In the studio today are two guests who have extraordinary amounts of determination. Our first playmaker is CEO of a company that has been a major reason why Dallas received a $4 billion, that's billion with a B, economic impact. Well, our next playmaker graduated from West Point, qualified as an Army Ranger, and at the same time received four master's degrees. With us today is a CEO who is the Dallas's number one salesperson, bringing business and people to Dallas. Well, our next playmaker is CEO of a company with over 100 plants in five states and D.C. These great playmakers are Philip Jones. Philip is CEO of the Dallas Convention Visitors Bureau, and William Sandbrook. Bill is CEO of U.S. Concrete, and we're going to begin today's show with Bill. Bill Sandbrook joined U.S. Concrete from Old Castle Products and Distribution, where he also served as CEO. In August 2011, Bill was chosen to be the president and CEO of U.S. Concrete. Through its operating companies, U.S. Concrete serves major construction markets in the United States in two business segments, ready-mixed concrete and aggregate products. The company provides its products and services from its operating companies in over 100 ready-mix plants and seven aggregate operations in California, New York, New Jersey, Oklahoma, Texas, and Washington, D.C. Bill is also a 1979 graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. While teaching at West Point, Bill also served as a social aide to President Ronald Reagan and earned his professional engineer's license in industrial engineering. Well, with all that, Bill, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, in reading about you is absolutely fascinating. I mentioned something at the top of the show, because you spent 13 years in the Army. You qualified as an Army Ranger and earned not one but four master's degrees while in the service. Talk about how and why you were able to accomplish all that in addition to being a mathematics teacher.
Sure, Steve. I was fortunate that my parents really gave me a love of learning, an early introduction to reading, and I was read and liked being as educated as I could be. I also like a challenge, and I also knew that I needed to be prepared. Whether I wanted to be a general or wanted to be a CEO of a company, I needed to be the best prepared that I could be. I figured that getting various master's degrees in various disciplines, an MBA, master's in systems engineering, a master's in public policy, and a master's in international relations would prepare me to be a general or to be a CEO of a major public company. Those are the reasons. The Ranger training, obviously I was going into the military and I wanted to be the best prepared I could to lead my soldiers into battle.
Well, a general and a CEO are comparable as far as running a company. They're both the head of whatever they're doing, so it prepared you well. Before the show started, we were talking about your background, and your dad was also in the concrete business. Was there a point where you decided the military was not for you and you wanted to go in the concrete business?
No, it didn't pan out like that at all. Actually, my father was not in the military, as you said, and we grew up moving from cement plant to cement plant across the country because he was in operations in the 1960s. When your company told you to move, you just saluted and moved. I was interested in the military but didn't have a background through my family, but decided at an early age that I wanted to attend West Point. Actually, it was the only college that I applied to, much to my parents' chagrin, and they were worried that I didn't have a backup plan, but I said I'd get in, and I did get in, and had full intentions of making the military my career until retirement. After Gulf War, the military was being drawn down because the Soviet Union had collapsed and they didn't need these big standing armies in Europe anymore. And they actually offered an early retirement package. And the prospects of a desk job in the Pentagon were not that appealing to me. I had these other opportunities and was prepared to go out into business and decided to make the jump. But I had every intention of staying in the military for a career.
Well, at the very least, there are more CEOs in business than there are generals in the Army, so there's more opportunities. But why West Point? Well, I want to talk about U.S. Concrete, but what was your rationale for only choosing West Point?
Well, as I said earlier, I look for a challenge. I thought that would challenge me both physically, mentally, and focused on that and to be an Army officer. And the Navy and Air Force never really appealed to me as much as leading soldiers into battle would potentially have been.
Well, you've been in the concrete business for a number of years. You came to U.S. Concrete in 2010, I believe it was.
2011.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. How did you turn a company around from its prepackaged bankruptcy back in 2010 to a $26 plus stock price today? Turnaround.
It's been a big turnaround, and I have great people that work with me. In turning around a company, you have to be passionate about it. Passion is infectious, and if the leader's passionate about whatever it may be, in our case, it's concrete. Your people tend to follow that lead. In coming to the company, you listen more than you talk. You don't people say you have a 90-day plan, a 60-day plan, lay it out. You really don't know that plan until you know what the problems may be and what the challenges may be. And you're kind of kidding yourself if you come in with a detailed plan. You need to find out exactly what the problems are. So you listen more than you talk. You're passionate about it, and then you believe in your people. You have small successes. You applaud those successes. You move forward slowly. You walk before you run. Surround yourself with good people, and it's a process and a journey. It doesn't happen overnight to turn a company around.
Well, you also sound like you're a relatively logical person. If that's not your nature, you probably picked up a lot of logic from teaching mathematics and being in the military. But that sounds like what you did. You sat down and you just logically figured out step by step what we have to do and didn't worry about going too fast or too slow. You just plotted ahead and made it happen.
No, that's a very good point. You can't move too fast because then you might go down the wrong path precipitously without really knowing the background. And you can't move too slow because obviously you're brought in there for a reason. But you applaud successes, you walk before you run, and then before you know it, you have a winning team.
Well, we also talked before the show started that you moved your headquarters from Houston to Euless, mm-hmm. to the Metroplex, 2012, 3 years ago. But you did that as a way to change the culture. Talk about the culture, mm-hmm. and why you wanted to make that change.
Sure. The previous culture of the company was one of command and control. All power and decisions emanated from the center, from the headquarters, and the operations were really treated as executing arms of the grand strategy and even the tactics of the center. In this type of business, it's a local business. Concrete can't be delivered that far. We have operations, as we said before, in California, New York, Washington, D.C., and Texas. You have to really empower your local team. You have to make your local team in charge of their own business as much as if they were a local entrepreneur in that market. They'll know their customers and their people better than you will from headquarters, and you have to empower them and entrust them with decision-making with the proper amount of control. But once you make them into owners, your job at the center becomes much, much more manageable, and you become much more effective. So we moved from Houston to Dallas to become closer to our operations. In Euless, we had an operating headquarters that runs our DFW locations. It was very important to get our headquarters staff in proximity, that they could walk down the hall and talk to local operating folks so they could walk in their shoes and make better decisions from the headquarters. And the local companies could then appreciate the stresses and strains on the headquarters staff as well, and made for a much more cohesive team.
You mentioned that you received your four masters because you wanted to prepare yourself for either being a general or being a CEO. Well, in talking to our next guest, you mentioned that you have approximately 2,100 employees across the United States. That's an army. Do you see a lot of what you learned to become a general and leading your men in battle to what you do as a CEO of U.S. Concrete?
Exactly. A leader is a leader. You can lead people in the Army, Air Force, Navy, or Marines, or you can lead people in a company. You can lead people in a nonprofit. But a leader is a leader, and there's certain attributes of believability. People want to follow somebody they believe, so you have to be brutally honest, good and bad. You have to have some of the vision thing. People want to think that you know where this company or this organization is going to be somewhere down the future. You need to have a plan. You need to empower people. You need to be concerned about your people. But it all comes down to believability. People can talk the talk, but you have to walk the walk.
Well, you were also spent 2 years as the Army Program Representative in Raytheon. Did that help you in understanding the transition from the military to corporate life?
It was my last assignment in the Army, and it certainly did, to see how the plant at Raytheon had 6,000 people under one roof. So there was some military aspects to it on command and control and how to lead a large organization, as well as in the civilian life, your troops, your employees don't necessarily have to salute, say yes, sir, and go along their way. There is a little bit of more leadership and persuasion necessary for people to follow you. So that was a good segue into the civilian transition.
You also, as I mentioned at the introduction, that you were a social aide to President Ronald Reagan, and mm-hmm. he was, if not my favorite former president, my favorite president. Tell us a little bit about working with President mm-hmm. Reagan.
Well, it wasn't for a very long time. In fact, it was for a couple days at his farewell address to the United Nations when he gave his closing remarks onto his presidency on a worldwide stage, and I was assigned to accompany him and actually introduce every UN delegate to him in a receiving line, which entailed me memorizing all of the UN delegates' name and then whispering, but I would say because of his hearing problems, shouting their names into his ear. Which is a very, very it's a very memorable experience for me. And he was just a very gracious, you know, just a great leader and a great American.
Well, he was called the great communicator, and a lot of people said that because he was in the movies. And my belief is he just understood how to communicate well with people. And even though he didn't have the hearing he had earlier in life, he did know how to communicate extremely well. And you obviously helped him with that. Well, you also received some recognition in the efforts at Ground Zero after September 11th. How were you involved?
That's another very interesting story. It's a culmination of being in the right place at the right time with the right authority. I was president of a company, one of the Oldcastle companies called Tilcon New York. We had a series of quarries and asphalt plants in the metro New York region. And that morning at about 9 o'clock, as everybody remembers, I'm sure, where you were at that point, I was in my office that was about 20 miles north of New York City. And we had the television on in one of the conference rooms, and somebody came into my office and said a plane had hit the Trade Center, and as everybody had thought, that this is some accident, some mistake, it's a Cessna or whatever. And then very quickly you saw it was not a Cessna, and it was something much more. Once we assessed that it had been some type of intentional act, I actually drove in my company car to the top of a quarry about 20 miles north of New York City. The second plane had hit by that time, and in the distance you could see the smoke. And as I listened to it on the radio, it was too far away to see, but had found out that the towers had collapsed. Very interesting time for a leader with your employees from that area, salesmen that were working down in the city, neighbors that worked down in the city, your own employees that were in shock, and you had to quickly come to some decisions, which we allowed people to leave, obviously, to check on their own families, to check on acquaintances and whatnot. So that evening, I decided that we could do something. I had the access to a lot of heavy equipment. We coordinated with the city, with the mayor's office, with the governor to bring down an equipment package to Ground Zero to help in the immediate rescue efforts. We assembled a large package of equipment, about 100 pieces of trucks and front-end loaders, met at the George Washington Bridge, were escorted down the Henry Hudson Parkway, were escorted onto Ground Zero the afternoon, early evening of September 12th, and then assisted in the removal of debris for the next 3 days until our equipment proved to be too large for the task at hand, at which time we pulled out our equipment.
Fascinating story. That's something I would like to continue, but we have been speaking with Bill Sandbrook. Bill is CEO of U.S. Concrete. Bill, thank you very much for being a part of Playmakers Talk Show. But before we go, tell everybody how they can find out more about U.S. Concrete on the internet.
If you want to find out more about U.S. Concrete in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, we operate under the trade name ReadyMix. You can go on the website, usconcrete.com, and find out more about us around the country.
Bill, thank you very much. Appreciate you being a part of Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you, Steve.
Don't go away. We have more. After we come back after this, we're going to talk to the number one salesperson for the city of Dallas. His name is Philip Jones. He is the CEO of the Dallas Convention Visitors Bureau. Back with Philip right after this.
Their names are Vivian, Bryce, Zoe, and Joshua, ages 5 to 12. They are part of a very exclusive club that neither they nor their families want to belong. They've all been diagnosed with some form of pediatric cancer. Each year in DFW, hundreds of families hear the dreaded words, "Your child has cancer." Wipe Out Kids Cancer helps families cope and support researchers looking for a cure. Our mission is simple, to work relentlessly for the day when all children are living cancer-free. Learn more at WOKC.org.
Operation Kindness is the oldest and largest no-kill animal shelter here in North Texas. Each day, its staff and volunteers care for an average of 300 homeless dogs and cats in its shelter in Carrollton, plus 100 more animals living in foster homes throughout the Metroplex. Learn how you can adopt, donate, or volunteer with this nonprofit group by visiting their website at operationkindness.org or by calling 972-418-7297. operationkindness.org.
And welcome back to Playmakers Talk Show. We're going to talk about the city of Dallas and everything that it's all about and bringing people here. We're going to speak with Philip Jones. He is the president and CEO of the Dallas Convention Visitors Bureau. He joined the D.C. or the Dallas Convention Visitors Bureau as president and CEO in 2003. He moved from Louisiana, where he served as secretary of the Louisiana Department of Culture, Recreation, and Tourism. Under Philip's direction, the Dallas CVB established additional sales forces in Austin, New York, and the West Coast to complement others in Chicago and Washington, D.C. In fiscal year 2013 through 14, the Dallas CVB booked a record of over 1.5 million room nights for future years, including 32 citywide meetings. Dallas is now the number one visitor destination in the state, number six convention city nationwide, and hosted 23.6 million visitors in 2013, resulting, as I mentioned at the top of the show, $4 billion direct economic impact. In 2014, the industry's residents report selected Dallas as number three in its top 50 U.S. destinations report and the only Texas city listed in the top 10. Well, Philip, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you, Steve.
If you're responsible for all that, that's really a big move. But let me ask you this first. This is a kind of an all-encompassing question. How does an LSU Tiger, a triathlete, and an Ironman athlete end up being the CEO for the Dallas Convention Visitors Bureau?
Well, just like anyone else, it's an interesting story when you end up in a position that you had no idea you'd ever be in. And when I was finishing up my term as Secretary of Tourism for the state of Louisiana, I got calls from various headhunters, and I was approached about the job in Dallas, a job in Hawaii, and a couple of other cities. And I said, wow, Hawaii, yeah, that sounds interesting. Dallas, no, not even interested. Don't bother me on that one. And of course, I went to Hawaii, took a look, and thought, gosh, I could be here for about a week, and I'd go crazy. And then I said, let me stop in on my way back and see what's happening in Dallas. And I got here, and it was just at the beginning of the transformation of the city, where there was, you know, sort of a reemergence of Dallas in the core of the city as a viable sort of destination. And I was blown away. And I was sold on it. And I arrived here, and literally the bureau that I took over was $3 million in debt. We're booking about a third of the room nights and a third of the citywides that we're booking today. And I had a real turnaround job ahead of me. But it was a huge challenge, great opportunity. But I recognize that there's something special about Dallas, and it's a real optimistic city that provides tremendous opportunity. And I was excited about it.
I want to talk about that turnaround, and I want to talk about the city of Dallas. But before we go there, I want to touch on this because I mentioned the question. You being a triathlete, and I believe you're going to be going to Hawaii for competition. What got you into that mode of physical activity?
Well, you know, as a kid growing up, I was always the very last person chosen for the football team or the baseball team or the basketball team. So I was never good at those traditional American sports. But in college, I started running and I realized I really liked it. And I realized I could actually do pretty well. And then I really, literally for 10 years, all I did was run races and marathons. And I enjoyed it, but I started to get burned out. So that, right at that time, triathlon was starting to come on as a sport. And I thought, well, let me try my hand at cycling. I loved it. And then I dipped my toe into swimming, and I had to really learn the proper way to swim. And I was hooked. And I've been hooked for over 20 years now as a triathlete. And I've been racing and competing at various levels. And I am really proud to say that I'm now ranked in the top 5% in my age group in the world for Ironman triathlon. And that's something I never imagined I would be able to say when I was growing up as a kid.
Well, congratulations. Well, of those three events within the triathlon, which is the most difficult for you?
The swim. I was not a natural swimmer, and I don't float very well. I don't have a whole lot of body fat. So it's like playing golf. If you learn how to do it properly, it's okay. And that's what I did. I joined a master swim team, and I learned the proper strokes and proper techniques. And I swam this morning, and I hate getting in the pool at 6 in the morning when it's cold, but I do it. I love to run and I love to cycle, so that balances it out. But, I'm actually now almost as good on the swim portion as I am on the run and the bike portion. So I'm fairly well-rounded now as a triathlete, but I could have never imagined being a proficient swimmer 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, if nothing else, remember every doctor I've talked to, they say swimming is one of the best exercises for you because it doesn't put pressure on any of your, any body parts, which I don't do as much as I should. Let's go to now the city of Dallas. And I've lived here for a number of years, and to me this is, without leaving Fort Worth, out the Metroplex, is the best place to live in the world as far as I'm concerned. You've turned it around. One of the things that I've noticed, I was in Victory Plaza, and I saw this great big sign out there that had a B and a G and was missing the I, but you could stand in the middle and have your picture taken. Talk about Dallas Big Celebration.
Well, we've been working very hard to position Dallas as a very appealing leisure destination as well as a business and convention destination. And one of the things that we recognize is people who live here, people who know the city, people who have visited the city in recent years, they really understand what's happened and the major transformation, the renaissance that's taken place in Dallas and all the new growth and development. But people who haven't been here, they still have that 1980s J.R. Ewing image of Dallas as a city. And so we wanted to really come up with a campaign that really captured the essence of what makes Dallas, Dallas. It's that city where optimism meets opportunity, where anything is possible. It's also known as Big D, everywhere you go. And so we came up with this big campaign, and we want you to be the I in big and make it your own personal experience. Make it your own personal Dallas. And so we put these B's and G's in about 20 locations around the city as sort of a test to see whether or not the local citizens would really embrace it. And it took off. And now we have, 40 locations around the city, and we have a waiting list a mile long of people and organizations that want the B's and G's to be in their venue or in their location. And we have people all over the world who come to town, and it's just like being in New York and taking a picture at the Statue of Liberty. They come to Dallas and they take a picture at the B&G. I was in Italy last week, and a journalist came up to me and said, look, here's my picture when I was in Dallas. It was her standing in the middle of the B&G at Victory Plaza.
Well, I carry my pictures on my phone around all the time and show people all over my pictures of my being in the middle between the B&G. I'm the I.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the turnaround. What was the first thing you did? Because one of the things I saw in your information was we're now the 7th top meeting destination in the U.S., top 3 tourism destination, for the happiest city in the nation. That you didn't have 100% to do with all of that, but you said you turned it around. What was the first thing you did to begin to turn around Dallas as the destination?
Well, we had to do an assessment of our strengths and weaknesses, and we recognized that there were some things missing in the package, if you will. And one of those key elements was we didn't have an attached convention center hotel. So it literally took us, they'd been trying to get one in place for 30 plus years, and it never happened. And so we had to go out and have a public vote and have the voters approve the public funding of the Omni Dallas Convention Center Hotel. And we promise the voters that if you give us this opportunity, we will prove to you it will be a big success. And we had a very difficult campaign. We were outspent somewhere 10-1, but former Mayor Tom Leppert helped lead the effort to make it happen, and we won by about 2,000 votes, and it's been a huge game changer for us. We've literally tripled business in Dallas since we put the Omni Dallas Convention Center in place, because it's helped bring groups that wouldn't even take a look at us before and put us back in under consideration and in rotation for a lot of these meetings. The other thing we've done is, you know, we've put together, I think, a very aggressive PR and marketing campaign to tell our story to the rest of the country and the rest of the world, and they like what they see when they come here. They have a great experience, and that's really helping us. And we've also helped create local brand ambassadors, just like yourself, who are proud of Dallas as a destination, and they're going out and telling our story and helping become strong advocates for all the changes and the positive developments in the city of Dallas today. So it's been a real collective effort between the citizens of Dallas, certainly the team I have at the Dallas Convention and Visitors Bureau. I think I have the best CVB staff in the country. They're passionate, they believe in the product, and they go out and they work very hard every day. And we're very fortunate to have the team in place that we have today.
Well, I'm thinking about it, the Convention Center, which is close to City Hall, it's a great place for it. But thinking back prior to the Omni, where was the closest hotel that conventioners could go to?
The Hyatt, you know, and it's just a few blocks away, but it's not connected.
That would have been a long walk, so they had to take a cab.
If it's 100 degrees in August, a lot of folks aren't excited about walking between the Hyatt and the convention center because of the temperature. And so we needed something connected. We also needed more meeting space, so the Omni helped us with that. But we're at the point now, literally, where we've had such success, we're outgrowing our convention center, and our next challenge is to really increase the size of the convention center and repurpose the space we have inside so we put more meeting space in as opposed to just more exhibit space. And so that's our next big challenge. But I think there's a huge potential list of clients that want to come to Dallas and meet because they like what they see in the city, but they don't fit. And so it's up to us to try and make that expansion happen and repurpose the convention center in a way that allows us to bring another $500 million worth of business to the city, which I think it's well worth it.
Well, you have some major competition with Las Vegas, with New Orleans, with Orlando. What's the next step in about the last 30 seconds or so? Where do you go to make Dallas even bigger in terms of a convention city?
Well, I think we have to continue to talk about the product improvement. We need to continue to add more hotel rooms downtown, and we have 6 hotels under construction in downtown Dallas. We have to continue to really help lead the development of ancillary developments such as the new high-speed rail and all the new downtown parks and all the new sort of repurposing of existing buildings in downtown to add a more residential and vibrant feel to the city. As that happens, we'll go out and tell our story, and people who, you know, hear it are impressed and they want to come and see it for themselves. And as a result of that, that's why we had a record year last year, and we're on pace for another record year this year.
So as much as you've done, there's more to come.
A lot more to do.
Well, Philip, thank you very much. If someone wanted to go to the website, where do they go to find out more about the city and conventions?
VisitDallas.com. We're going to keep it and make it really simple for people, and there's a lot of information on there. There's sample itineraries. There's a list of upcoming events and activities, and there are lots of cool photos that you can use and share. And you know, please do so you can help us sell the city of Dallas as the ideal destination for meetings, conventions, and leisure business.
Especially for residents, because we don't always do the things that need to be done here in Dallas. Well, Philip, thank you very much
for being
part of Planners Talk Show. Philip Jones, CEO of Dallas Convention and Visitors Bureau. This has been a great show. Join us at PlaymakersTalkShow.com, where you can get all of our replays and past episodes. That's PlaymakersTalkShow.com. We'll be back next week with more Playmakers. See you then.
Who will Steve be interviewing next? Find out on Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein every Friday afternoon at 3 on 770 KAAM. Hear this interview again by going to Steve's website, PlaymakersTalkShow.com.